Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. There's a classic moral dilemma that goes something like this. A train is speeding down the tracks. It keeps going. And if you do nothing, it's going to kill five people. If you change the train's direction, which you can, only one person will die. What do you do? There are different schools of thought on how to answer this question, and you can see what brand of morality you subscribe to with a quick online search. But there might be an even more important issue at play here. How do you come to your conclusion? How are you weighing right and wrong? As we've been able to peer closer and closer at the workings of the brain, what we know about morality and what motivates us to do good has shifted.
For a long time, I think scientists have focused on the innate side of morality because we have wonderful tools in evolutionary theory that allow us to predict how cooperation evolves, how punishment evolves, all these rich moral concepts. I think one of the really exciting things that's happening in the field now is that theories of learning are starting to be developed that are precise enough that we can understand how learning also contributes to moral psychology. And we're now trying to put those together and pick apart what is innate and what is learned.
Fiery Cushman is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard. He studies the science of morality, and he says researchers are finding we might become good by practicing being good. And that practice even spills over into actions that we don't necessarily want to take.
When I go to Europe, I can't help tipping 20%. It just feels absolutely wrong to me not to put a 20% tip on the table, even though I know that that's not the local custom. So why do I do that? It's probably not because I have a great love of European waitstaff and I just need to see them go home with extra money. We think about it as a kind of a moral habit. So again and again, we practice what the right thing to do is in this situation. And then even when the situation changes and the underlying rationale no longer applies, that habit persists.
Another way to figure out whether actions come from practice is to give people cash and ask if they'd be willing to share it with someone they don't know. In one test, experimenters handed out money and sat back to see what would happen.
What they looked at is how long it would take people to decide what to do. The people who decide very quickly and are presumably therefore doing something habitual, they actually give the money. People who take a long time and deliberate and think about it are more likely to keep the money for themselves. So what that indicates to us is that maybe contrary to our just an ordinary person's thinking about how morality works, where our impulse is to be selfish and then with great control and effort we can do the right thing, it actually looks like often we do the right thing habitually. What takes some effort and control is to set aside our morals for the purpose of self-interest.
Is neuroscience, are brain scans reinforcing that idea that morality is very teachable and very malleable?
Well, yes, in the sense that about 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of people were running studies where they said, can we identify the moral part of the brain? That is, the part of the brain that encodes moral rules and that is distinctive and special. 15 years later, nobody's found it, and most people have given up hope that it's there. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't moral. What it means is that moral decision-making is basically a lot like other kinds of decision-making. And in the same way that we can exert self-control, improve and develop our own habits in domains from, gambling to deciding what job to take to deciding who to marry, we should be able to use those same neural mechanisms to decide what kind of a moral creature we want to be and to change ourselves and our society over time.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's apply this to something that's been in the national discussion a lot when you think about issues of right and wrong, which is punishment. And, there's been a lot of discussion of the prison population. We've got an awfully big one in the U.S. And, there's been talk about, is it too big? Do we punish too much, the wrong choices, the quote-unquote wrong choices that people make. How has the work that you've done made you think differently, if at all, about that sort of national discussion?
Well, one of the things that we've studied the most in our lab is something that philosophers call moral luck. And we've shown that moral luck is really pervasive in punishment. So imagine that you and I, after this interview, went out and got some beers together, and then both of us are driving home, and both of us fall asleep at the wheel and run off the road.
Okay.
You run into some bushes. In Massachusetts, you'd get a ticket, maybe a point off your license. I run into a person in their front yard and kill them. In Massachusetts, I'd get 2.5 to 15 years in prison. So you can see why philosophers call this moral luck.
Right.
The two of us engaged
in
completely
thing.
Identical behavior, right. Totally different amounts of punishment. And we've shown that that pattern of judgment is present by the time that kids are 4 years old, and that it seems to be a very deeply rooted, and in this case, perhaps innate, part of our moral psychology. The question is, once you understand that that's the way the human mind is built, do you want to endorse it? Is that the way our laws should be designed? Or do you want to question it and say, given that people are engaging in identical behavior, does it make sense to treat them identically?
Well, that brings up the question, why do we judge people so harshly if they don't have the intent to hurt someone? I mean, in fact, someone else may have taken the same actions, but they didn't end up hurting anyone purely by chance.
What we've learned is that it seems to be an efficient way to teach somebody when you don't have language. So we both have young daughters. Imagine that your daughter, before she can talk, she spills a glass of milk on the carpet. That's kind of bad luck. I mean, she certainly wasn't trying to ruin your day. There
right.
was no bad intent.
right.
But if you don't take the opportunity to show her that you're upset, then you've missed a teachable moment.
Right.
So our thinking is that maybe this instinct to punish accidents evolved before we had language, when the only way to communicate to someone was to take advantage of those accidents and say, hey, look, that's the thing I don't want you to do.
Right.
Today we do have language, and nobody gets in a car drunk without realizing that it's against the law. So the thought is maybe we have a leftover sort of evolutionary vestige from a time when we didn't have language that we're applying now in a way that fundamentally doesn't really make sense.
Well, you could also say in some ways that the person who gets punished for driving drunk bears the punishment of like all the people who drive drunk, because when you drive drunk, you spin the wheel of luck, and sometimes you lose, and sometimes, you know, maybe you run into bushes and you're okay.
Yeah, that's right. But one of the interesting things we've found is that people only make decisions about punishment that way. They don't make other kinds of moral decisions that way. So let me explain what I mean. Suppose that we have one person come into the lab. We give them the drunk driving case. We say, how much punishment should they get? Like I say, they're going to let you off very lightly. They're going to send me to prison. But we bring someone else in the lab and we say, who's a worse person? They would actually judge us identically. We bring a third person in the lab and we say, who would you trust to babysit your daughter? They're going to treat us identically. We bring a fourth person in. Who engaged in morally worse behavior? They say, well, it was the same behavior. So the fact that punishment sticks out as the one type of moral evaluation where luck plays a big role, I think gives us some additional reason to question whether that's a reasonable response.
So in general, when it comes to justice or crime, we want to use punishments as instruments to teach people about something, as you were saying. Are punishments good ways of teaching either the offender, like they won't do it again, or just the general population? If you do this, you'll be treated like this person.
I think most of the evidence suggests that the most effective form of punishment is social sanction. It's when you realize that you've upset your community and that they're upset with you, you know, that they disapprove of your behavior. And I think one could argue that the criminal justice system that we've developed now imposes a lot of pain on people, but in a very disconnected, institutionalized way. I think most people would say, most parents would say, if you want to change your child's behavior, more effective than just imposing the maximum suffering on them is making them understand how much they've hurt you and how their behavior is unacceptable in your eyes. Maybe there's something we can learn from that parenting setting and apply to social policy.
How has our view, and we've talked about this a little bit, but how has our view of right and wrong changed in recent years? What do you think, and where do you think science is going in terms of what it's teaching us?
Right around the year 2000, several papers came out, one by my colleague Josh Green, another by Jonathan Haidt, then at the University of Virginia, that taught us that so much of our ability to do the right thing and to know what to have beliefs about what the right thing is grounded in intuition. What seems to be genetically built in is a basic level of caring about other people. Mm-hmm. What needs to be learned is the connection between that basic level of caring and particular actions. So, for instance, in my lab, we ran a study a number of years ago where we brought people in and we gave them a disabled handgun. So it was heavy, metal, looked just like a real gun, but we showed them that it was completely fake. And then I, or more often my graduate students, sat down in a chair and said, "Shoot me in the head." People are extremely averse to doing that. And how do you explain that aversion? It can't be innate because we didn't evolve in an environment with handguns. So right. there's no innate basis, right? On the other hand, what we believe is innate is that people don't like to do violence to other people. But if you start with the principle, don't do violence to other people, and then you add a learning process that connects that abstract aversion to harm to particular actions, then what you can get is a kind of irrational aversion to even using a toy gun to pretend to shoot a person. And part of the reason we were interested in this is because there's actually a large body of evidence from battlefield contexts that soldiers can't bring themselves to shoot. In fact, by some estimates, up to 80% of soldiers on the front line, when aiming at another human, can't bring themselves to shoot.
They've been through training that do this.
I mean, they've been through training, and they're also being shot at.
Right.
This is the one way to save. I'll give you an example. In the Battle of Gettysburg, at the end of the battle, 27,500 muskets and rifles were collected. Most of them were muzzle loaded, so you had to stuff the cartridge down, and then you could shoot. Because it takes a long time to get a new cartridge ready and a short time to shoot it, most of those guns should have been empty. Because as soon as you had it loaded, there was a wall of enemy in front of you that you could shoot at. But instead, 90% of them were loaded. Half of them were loaded twice. A third of them were loaded, three times or more. One of them was loaded over 20 times. So what were those soldiers doing? Why would you stand, load your weapon, not shoot it, load it again, not shoot it again until somebody shoots you? The best accounts that are out there suggest that people are in a situation where they don't want to be a coward and run away, but they can't bring themselves to pull the trigger and kill another human. And so they stand there loading their weapon and pretending to shoot until somebody finally shoots them.
So against the backdrop of what has been discovered about moral decision making, if we look forward, what are the questions that you want to see answered when it comes to morality and right and wrong?
Well, I'll give you one very concrete example and one very big picture example.
Okay.
Just to continue on this military theme for a moment, I've heard anecdotally, and actually, I was just speaking with someone, a military officer, a few days ago who confirmed these anecdotes, that the Air Force has found a much higher rate of psychological casualty, that is, Air Force members who are dealing with psychological trauma, among their drone pilots than their traditional pilots. And the reason seems to be that the drone pilots will monitor their target for days and at some level get to know about them. They'll be watching a live video feed of the person understanding their daily routine,
right.
So that they can find an opportunity to strike one target without collateral damage. I think in a lot of the national conversation about drones, we've had an attitude that this removes us from war. There's a strange sense in which it might actually be bringing us a lot closer to war. A much more abstract question that we're trying to answer. Like I say, in 15 years of research on the neuroscience of morality, the consistent story has been it's just general purpose learning and decision-making mechanisms that handle moral learning and moral decision-making. It's hard to argue against all the papers. On the other hand, making moral decisions just feels really different than making other types of decisions in life. It feels like if I'm at the restaurant and I'm choosing between steak and salad, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I could make a better decision. I could make a worse decision. It's no big deal. If I'm making a decision between your life and mine, it feels like this really matters, and there's some absolute constraints on what I could possibly do, what kinds of considerations could possibly count. And we just haven't been able to convincingly capture that in the neuroscience. So something's got to give. Either we've been doing 15 years of neuroscience wrong, or we've been thinking about morality the wrong way. And I'm just totally excited to find out what the answer to that question is.
Fiery Cushman is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.